52 committee, we passed out with the Dash 3 amendments. As you may recall, the fiscals were too large, and we had to take out the portion that was Section 1 of the bill that would create aggravated identity theft. And so that we would only have the section that was left that said that you could aggregate certain crimes, and we were adding forgery and identity theft. Aggregate means, for forgery means, if someone wrote three checks that in total were worth $750 or more, you could prosecute them for a felony because forgery has a dollar amount. Well, I forgot to take identity theft out of that now that we had Section 1 gone. So this amendment, the Dash 4 amendment, would take identity theft out of that section of the venue statutes, section subsection 12 of ORS 131.315, because without Section 1, you cannot aggregate identity theft. So that would be what the Dash Force would do. It would correct my mistake.
All right. Very, very appropriately and rightfully said. And consider yourself whipped with a wet noodle.
All right. Thank you.
After we fire our counsel, I move the rules be suspended for the
that wasn't in the script.
That was not in the script, yeah.
Let me revise my motion, Mr. Chairman.
Okay.
I move that the rules be suspended for the purpose of reconsidering the vote on Senate Bill 52.
All right, Senator Burdick moves the rules be suspended for the purpose of reconsidering the vote by which we passed out Senate Bill 52. Discussion on the motion? Any objections to the motion? Motion passes. Madam Vice Chair, or Madam Vice, as you're
Mr.
more affectionately.
Mr. Chairman, I move the Dash 4 amendments to Senate Bill 52.
All right, Senator Burdick now moves the Dash 4 amendments to Senate Bill 52. Discussion on the motion? There's no discussion. Any objection to the adoption of the Dash 4 amendments? There is none. Motion passes.
Chairman.
Senator Burdick.
I move Senate Bill 52 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
All right. Senator Burdick now moves Senate Bill 52 as amended to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any objections to the motion? Motion passes. And who was the carrier?
I was.
Okay, good. I will carry it again.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
All right. What other fun stuff do we have here? We have expands the crime of abuse to the memorial.
Yeah,
who's the best?
What?
The committee that from the Parks Department, Parks and Recreation.
All right, let's do that one. 2206. Sounds like an exciting bill.
Chair, members of the committee, this bill comes to you from the State Parks and Recreation Department. It includes when the crime of abuse memorial to the dead, the buying, selling, or transporting of a two-monument gray stone fence railing a curb that was stolen from a pioneer cemetery and increases the maximum fine to $50,000 if the item destroyed or stolen came from a pioneer cemetery. Requires the court to consider restitution.
All
you have the Dash A version in front of you, Mr. Chair.
Great. Thank you. Mr. Is it Hamrick? Is that correct?
Morning, Mr. Chairman. James Hamrick. I'm an assistant director at Oregon Parks and Recreation Department, and I manage the Oregon Pioneer Cemetery Commission, soon to be renamed the Oregon Commission on Historic Cemeteries. This bill is brought to you on behalf of the commission, which was created in 1999 and placed in the department. And one of the things that they were requested to do was to look at existing legislation and to recommend to the Assembly a new legislation that might increase the protection of historic cemeteries. This bill, and I've in my letter to you, I've attached a number of articles. There are plenty more of them, which indicate that cemetery vandalism is a pretty serious problem statewide. And the committee felt that the current $5,000 maximum fine for a Class A misdemeanor for destroying these cemeteries or defacing or stealing or otherwise selling these monuments was not enough. And so the commission recommended that the fine be increased to $50,000, and the House Judiciary Committee agreed. And so the other thing that this bill would do would be to give the court, in a conviction, the authority to actually ask for restitution by the parties doing the damage, and to do so at the at what the value would be historically, which means that if you've got a 100-year-old intricately carved stone monument, that the restitution wouldn't be that they just put a slab back, a current slab. So those are the two things that are the major components of the bill. This bill has quite a bit of support statewide by local cemetery associations. Most of these associations are run by volunteers, local folks. They have really quite attached to their cemeteries, and they believe that this might help law enforcement give it a little bit more teeth to try to slow down this vandalism trend. So, Mr. Chairman, I would be happy to answer any questions.
All right. Thank you. Committee, any questions? Senator Ringo.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Are you aware of circumstances where the police have apprehended some cemetery vandals and prosecuted them?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Ringo, we don't have any statistics relating to that, no. Generally, most of these crimes are done in the dead of night, and it's very hard to catch people.
Dead of night?
Mr. Chair, I just think this is yet one more example of us passing a bill to make us feel like we're doing something, but it really isn't going to make any difference. So just another cynical comment from the side of the...
Well, you're doing quite well at your cynicism.
Especially, you know, if there were examples where people had been apprehended or that people were somehow fearful of a penalty and knew that penalties might be raised, but I just don't see this having that effect. I'm not saying I'm going to vote no. I just I don't think this is going to slow down one iota people that are going to vandalize your cemeteries.
Right. Senator Burdick and then Council.
Yielding to council.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senator Burdick, thank you. I just add an additional fact that we did here in the House, and I read some articles in the New York Times, among other places, that in some places, for example, in Louisiana, and I think they mentioned in Pioneer Cemeteries, there's a growing business of stealing objects for sale. And this does try to address at least somewhat the fact it includes buy, sells, or transports any object that was stolen from a Pioneer Cemetery, knowing that the object is stolen. So there is an extension there.
I see. Yeah. Okay. Mr. Chair, maybe we can put the offenders in the tombs.
You're starting to sound like me.
In the dead of night.
I do have one point I wanted to raise. We did pass out of this committee earlier a piece of legislation that would require restitution to be imposed. I'm not sure what the status of that bill is in the House, and then the language in this bill says shall consider that the defendant pay restitution. So it may need some conflict amendments.
Sure, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. That was hotly debated in the House, as I think a witness may remember, in the committee. On one point, there was an amendment that said that restitution shall be paid. And some of the members of the committee were not comfortable with mandating restitution. And then one other member pointed out that we already had a restitution statute that was discretionary with the judge. So in the spirit of compromise, the committee compromised with the language shall consider,
okay,
which in many words is may.
Right, and I think what you're cryptically telling me is that other bill may not be...
Mr. Members of the committee, I don't
moving know. Through the process. Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Walker.
I have a concern about this bill because, while I appreciate we need to respect the dead and our historic cemeteries, this bill would cause a $50,000 fine for anybody who intentionally destroys, mutilates, removes, cuts, breaks, or injures any tree, shrub, or plant within any structure. I thought that I think that that's I think this is a little bit much.
Mr. Chairman, if I may,
so
yes,
you
can
respond, sir.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Walker, if you note under the under Section 3A, the B is not included in there. So the under B, the business about the shrubs and the trees would stay a $5,000 fine. The $50,000 fine maximum would be only for the tombs or in other words, A and C above. And so B is excluded from that maximum.
I see. I don't read it that way, but...
Senator Burdick.
Do you have any plans to post the increased penalties at any of these cemeteries?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Burdick, I believe that if this bill passes that we will engage in a relatively aggressive sort of education campaign, which could include that type of signing. Yes. I mean, the idea is to get the word out as much as possible.
Well, that's good. I think posting it right at the cemetery in a way that's not too disruptive to the mood of the place would be really good. I have relatives from both sides of my family buried in these pioneer cemeteries, sometimes with, you know, really one-of-a-kind stones, and it really is a place of history. My daughter and I go out and do the little tour every Memorial Day, so it's one of those special things, and I commend you for bringing this forward. And contrary to my good colleague, Senator Bingo, I would hope that it would do some good. I know he hopes it would do some good.
Yes, I do.
Especially if it's posted. And people know that it's a very serious matter.
All righty. So, how many votes do we have? One, two, three. Okay.
No, yeah. Given that the $50,000 fine isn't for a shrub, I can probably go there. I mean, I thought that was a bit much, so I appreciated the clarification.
Okay, we'll do a work session on 2206.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Burdick.
I move House Bill 2206 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Burdick moves House Bill 2206 unamended to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. Is there any objection? There's no objection. Motion passes. And who wants to carry this?
I'll carry
this bill. Senator Burdick will carry the bill.
And she has relatives.
Hopefully it will be after Memorial Day, so I'll be able to provide fresh insight to the grave situation out there.
Mr. Hamrick, thank you very much.
Thank you, Senator, and thank you for moving me up on the list.
Yeah. Well, we got to get the next most exciting thing in our agenda, and that's child support. Okay, here comes the fun.
Time to go get mine.
Wait a second. We have one more bill we need to get. 2034. Is that your bill?
That's correct, Mr.
Okay.
Chairman.
Work session on 2034.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, we do have a witness signed up, but we also had a hearing on this bill on the 30th. This comes at the request of Representative Alan Brown for Lincoln County Government. It modifies, it's basically a housekeeping bill for our mass statutes, modifies the definition of iodine matrix. It allows the state police to inspect sales records of retail wholesalers. There's also a provision in here that is somewhat the provision in the exemption in the law for doctors for veterinarians. You do have a dash A7 amendments in front of you, but I understand the proponents of these amendments, Mr. Bovette, has decided not to go forward with these amendments. These amendments were considered in the House and not moved on.
Right. Okay. So the bill needs no amendments.
That's correct. We have a...
And we have Ms. Marcia Keith. You're here. You support the bill. It fixes a problem. Right. Okay.
Mr. Chair, I don't have my bill file. My staff inadvertently gave me all the bill files for tomorrow. But is this the one where they wanted to put the stuff behind the counter?
Yes, that's correct.
Oh, I remember that.
That's
that's the amendment we're not considering.
Right, we're not putting it.
And the other one was sort of an inadvertent thing that happened from last session.
That's correct.
Okay, I remember this bill. This is a good bill, but
right.
Not with the amendment.
Correct.
Okay.
So...
Chairman.
Madam Vice Chair,
would you like a motion?
I would love An amendment. A motion.
I move House Bill 2034, unamended, to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
All right. Senator Burdick moves House Bill 2034, Ann Gross, unamended, to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Discussion on the motion. There is no discussion. Any objection to the motion? There is no objection. The motion passes. And Senator Starr, would you carry this one?
All good.
Thank you, sir. All right. Now for the fun and exciting stuff. Ronell Shankel, you are our star witness today. Let me see. Yes, you are. Look at this. Nobody else had the courage to face off with you here. Look at that, these truly are housekeeping. Let's see. What should we start with? Which one's the most exciting, Ronell?
Most exciting. Well, the most complicated is the one he's passing out right now, which is 2095.
That's the most complicated?
That's the most complicated.
Okay, that one drops to the bottom.
All right, let me grab the other testimony. The simplest one, if you want to go in reverse, is 2114. It's customer service only.
Let's do 2114.
I don't need to go back to my office and get my bill files on these.
Do you want to take a minute to get
it? No.
Or send a cryptic message via the airwaves to your staff?
She's still getting ready for the day.
Uh-huh. Here you go.
Ronell came in busy.
Okay.
Good morning. For the record, Ronell Shankel with the Department of Justice, here today in support of House Bill 2114. You have the A. and Gross version in front of you, I believe. This bill is a pure customer service issue for the child support program, and it has to do with the administrative child support garnishments that we do on primarily on financial accounts, but other assets as well. Briefly, the essence of this bill talks about those cases where we have obligors, parents who are ordered to pay child support, and they have more than one child support case. The Department of Justice, by contract, is the office responsible for doing the majority of the administrative garnishments in the program. We use a process that the legislature gave us called Financial Institution Data Match, where financial institutions give our program information about accounts. We turn around and generate administrative garnishments in keeping with the garnishment statutes. If an obligor has more than one case, we will generate multiple garnishments at one time. Currently, what occurs is whichever envelope the financial institution opens first, they apply funds to that, and if the funds run out, no one else gets any funding. The proposal here would allow us to issue still all of those garnishments, but they would go together with one sort of cover memo that would instruct the financial institution the total of all the garnishments. They would send us funding up to that total, and we would then distribute according to the normal child support distribution rules so that all cases get some of the funding. That, in a nutshell, is what this bill before you does. In the House side, well, actually prior to that, we used the Oregon Law Commission work group that is handling judgments but also did a garnishment cleanup bill with Chair Williams. We used them as a sounding board for this bill. And to our knowledge, no one has any concerns about it.
Counsel, what do you think?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, garnishments is always, for some people, a very interesting topic.
Yes, it is.
I think, as Ms. Shankel has said, it's been through the Law Commission because they will soon see a rewrite of the garnishment statutes, and it fits in with that. So.
Mm-hmm. All righty then.
Mr. Chairman.
Me, Senator Farrelly.
Chairman, just a question relative to child support payments. Maybe related to the rate of topic, perhaps not related to the specificity of the bill. Who calculates the interest due on past due child support payments?
Chairman, Senator Farrelly, you and I had a brief conversation about interest, and for the record and for the committee, the child support program, our computer system, does not compute the interest. When we enter orders, we do order that interest shall accrue, but we do not compute it and add it to the record. I pulled our current administrative rule on that topic, Senator, and it's 461-200-5080. And the rule says that upon request of a party, and normally that would be the obligee or the custodial parent, and upon them providing us with the documentation calculating the interest, that we will add it to the case and collect it and enforce it. It does not require that it be done by a certified public accountant, as we discussed earlier. In fact, the parent could do it themselves by filling out the form, either manually or running it on software that they have on their home computer. But as long as they fill out the form, sign it, and say this is the interest due, we serve a copy on the other party, and if there's no objection, we would then add it to the case, enforce it, and collect it.
Mr. Chairman, I just can't quite get my mind around the idea that a person who has a child support judgment would go to the agency with the request for an enforcement of an order, and the agency would tell them that they are responsible to calculate the interest and to submit that document to the agency, whereupon the agency would receive the document, and if there's no objection or contest to the amount, then that amount is added to the judgment, and then it goes after collection. It just seems to me that even handheld pocket computers have the capability, or calculator has the capability of computing interest, and it's just beyond me that the agency would shove that back at what I would assume normally is a frustrated, angry, upset individual who's already feeling the financial pinch and the frustration of having not received court-ordered collections, and have the agency essentially respond by saying, well, you calculate the interest, and if nobody objects, we'll add it to the order. I don't know that that's the agency's deficiency so much as it is ours. But it seems just real illogical to me that on the child support payments, we make the the holder of the order do their own calculations for interest.
Well, maybe the next question is, why do we do it that way?
Chairman, it's two primary reasons on that topic. One is the computerized system that we use to do our accounting receipting distribution is a mainframe system that has to meet federal requirements, many federal requirements, and Oregon is certified and does so. To put what would seemingly be a simple interest calculation onto that program, unfortunately, is not a simple process because it is an old, ancient mainframe that we would be working on. In addition to
that...
When
you say old and ancient, how old and ancient is it?
I do not know the origin of the system.
It's not one of the old Wang systems.
It's not that old. When I started, we had Wangs, Chairman. We actually reside on the Department of Human Services mainframe system. We have screens that run through that program. I think the second more important point on many of our cases is we have obligors who are either unwilling or unable. We have both. And if they're not paying their child support, adding interest on top of it does not necessarily generate an increase in payment. Sometimes it has the reverse effect. So we do leave that option to that obligee, but the senator is correct in that we also ask the obligee to provide some paperwork.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Ringo.
I mean, I just disagree with Senator Farrelly's position on this. I think that there are many instances where the interest calculation is very complex. You have 1 month the payment was 10 days late, the next month is 20 days late, then you when you have a number of irregular payments, it's a nightmare to calculate it. And are we gonna ask the court staff to do that? Are we gonna put the burden on the court staff if they make a mistake? And you know, I guess just the way I've seen the court operate and the court clerks operate, they shuffle paperwork. They're not responsible for providing that kind of analysis, and I think that would be imposing a new task on them.
So. I think it's pretty clear that as an entity, the state pretty well sucks at collecting fees and fines and forfeitures and calculating interest and anything that has to do with collecting money owed, and we're just not any good at it. So that's one of those areas that getting you know, some other financial institution that seems to be, they seem to be really good at it, to
Mr. Chairman,
do those calculations.
I appreciate the comments of my colleague. I understand that they can be complicated. As a matter of fact, a lot of times people have to go seek an accountant to do the calculation. I just wanted to bring it to the attention of the committee that there's an issue that I think is sometimes beyond the capability of the holders of the judgment. And it just seems unreasonable to push that. Yeah, if the worksheet is there on the counter, it seems to me that it wouldn't be a great burden on the agency to provide some interest-capable calculators and help walk people through that.
Well, you know, I just think it's amazing. Having been in this building for a long time, and serving in Ways and Means in 91 and 93 and the unfortunate year 95, that we talked a lot about, you know, advanced open architecture type of systems, having computer systems that will do this kind of stuff. But we, as a state, it's not the Department of Justice, as a state, we just suck at it. We're just not good at it. I think our whole motivation and how we look and view our computer systems are not consistent with how the private sector views what those systems can do for them. But that's a whole separate issue, I think. So thanks for throwing that in the midst of this. Any other
utterly irrelevant
left, out of left field questions here? Okay, work session on 21-14.
Mr. Chairman.
Everyone okay here?
Okay.
Senator Burdick.
I move House Bill 21-14, unamended to the Senate floor for the due pass recommendation.
Senator Burdick moves House Bill 21-14, engrossed, unamended to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Any additional discussion? None? Zero?
Zero.
Okay. Any objections to the motion? There are no objections. Motion passes, and Senator Ariely,
I will.
Would you carry that?
Thank you
so much. All right, now, which is the next least most complex bill?
I would actually say 2113. It is a federal mandate, but it's a single topic in that bill.
Oh, good. I love federal mandates. Public hearing. Senator,
again, for the record, Ron L. Shankle with the Department of Justice. You have before you House Bill 2113A engrossed. This is a federal mandate. It is not new, however. It actually falls within state plan compliance for the child support program in that the federal regulations related to the confidentiality of our records have been changed. What you will see when you receive my written testimony is that it is Oregon Revised Statute 25260 that lays out the confidentiality of child support program records, and the Code of Federal Regulations that was based on CFR 45303.21 was repealed and has not yet been replaced by the federal government. They are working on a replacement, but they cannot give us a draft copy yet and do not know exactly when that will be released. In the meantime, that left us with some language in the United States Code and definitely is much stricter interpretation than the previous regulation about who has access to our information. What we're seeking to do with this is list the two types of entities we know are entitled still to child support information. Those would be programs under Title 4A or the TANF programs within DHS, as well as Title 19 or the Medicaid. There are many other partners that currently have access to child support records that may not have such broad access, at least in the future. And in the statute, we're asking that in addition to listing those two qualified groups, we would also like rulemaking authority, and the rules would mirror our federal regulations once they are issued with regard to any other partners that would have access. Let me clarify that when I talk about access, I certainly do not mean that this is a change for any of the Department of Justice Division of Child Support staff, nor is it a change for any of the county district attorney staff that work on child support cases or employment hearing officers who are hearing our cases. This is partners beyond that that provide other services to families that we will need to tighten up or at least restrict the way they obtain information from us. In the background, we already have partnership groups working on what that will look like in the future. We want to ensure that people still get the information they need from us. They are just likely to get it in a different manner. You will notice that there was an amendment on the House side to this bill. It was adding some clarifying language specifically about access to the federal parent locate system and how entities get access to that information through us.
All right. So you have provided for us the federal code, I assume, that mandates this change? Or
the federal regulation was actually repealed, and it leaves Chairman Minnis just the United States code to base our statute on in the meantime.
All right. So point this out to us. What is it in the federal code that's mandating this change?
One moment. The regulation, did you receive a regulation in your packet or just the code?
Well, I'm trying to figure out.
Okay, you have the code. I can tell.
Document here, I got U.S. code collection, and it goes on.
Yes, and 654A of the code.
Say what again?
654A, I believe it's on page 5 of that document. 654A actually talks about automated data processing. All child support records are, in fact, in a computerized system. If you go down to small, one moment. Small C, which is quite long, and you make your way to page 5, you'll notice, excuse me, we're on sub F at that point. Number 3 talks about people who have access and we exchange information with the temporary family assistance and the Medicaid agencies.
You're on page 5?
Correct.
Okay. Counsel, can you point this out to the chair?
Mr. Chair, I'm having trouble finding the right page.
All right.
Is this the page you're talking about? Which says, chapter at the top, it says Title 42, Chapter 7, and then it says page 5 of 11.
No.
Uh-huh. We're in the wrong document.
Would you like me to bring my copy up?
Would you?
I will.
So it would be further back in the second document. I'm still.
My apologies. We gave you another cross-reference section of the code just to be thorough, and that may have been more confusing.
Ms. Shankle, are you talking about the provision that starred here?
That is correct.
Which reads, temporary family assistance and Medicaid agencies exchanging information with state agencies of the state and other states administering programs funded under Part A of this subchapter. Programs operated under a state plan approved under this subchapter. That would be XIX of this chapter and other programs designated by the Secretary as necessary to perform state agency responsibilities under this part and under such programs?
Those are the only entities, the TANF or the Title 4A and the Medicaid Title 19, that we can find specifically named in our child support code. And that's the language we're using to say in the amendment in the statute that they are still entitled to information. Beyond that, we anticipate that the rest of the partnership will be laid out in the regulation when they issue that. The previous regulation, if I might, Chairman, had a long list of partners. It listed titles 1, 10, 14, and it went on. There was quite a significant list, and that no longer exists.
All right. I must be kind of dense today. So run this through again. What happened and why are we doing this?
The Code of Federal Regulations 303.21 was repealed. That section is titled Safeguarding Information, and it contained a whole list of entities that were entitled to receive child support information.
Right.
That list is gone, and our statute was based on that reg.
Okay. And
so we went searching for the code language, since the regulation giving us the detail doesn't exist at this time. And in the code, we found that section that Council Taylor pointed out that says, to us at least clearly, the TANF partner agency and the Medicaid are still entitled to child support information, but we find no one else listed in the code at this time. So in our statute, we're seeking to say that those two entities are still entitled to information and that we would like rulemaking authority to mirror any regulation they issue in the future so that if they determine that other agencies are entitled to information, we won't be bound by that singular statute.
Well, has the federal government complained about how we're doing it?
Our statute is out of compliance at this time because it is too broad.
Who told us that?
The Region 10 Office of Child Support Enforcement.
Do you have a letter, some document?
I do not have a letter. I likely could obtain one for you. I'm certain that it was done by email up until this point, but I can obtain one, Chairman.
Yeah, I'd like to get some document. But you're saying that the federal government may at some future time provide additional detail?
They're telling us that they are, in fact, drafting it. However, they cannot release it at this time.
Okay, and if we don't comply, what's the penalty?
The potential penalty for the child support program, this is a state plan compliance issue, and state plan issues are a loss of federal matching funds to the program first, which currently would be $85 million, and then there can also be assessed a penalty against the TANF block grant starting at a 1% increment and moving upwards. And I have that figure for you. 1% just for the first year is $1,670,000, and then it incrementally increases until we bring the plan back into compliance.
Okay. Well, why don't you give me a letter, something from the feds that are telling us why this is necessary and what they're planning to do in the future. Does this impact law enforcement agencies' access to this material?
It does not, Chairman. This is related to rather direct exchange of information and access. It does not impact law enforcement access, which is actually under the federal parent locate service and the state parent locate service process. That has not changed.
All right. Good. Thank you. Other questions?
Yeah, Mr. Chair. Ms. Schenkel, I wouldn't want your job. and one of the reasons I wouldn't is because it seems to me that you're always trying to catch up with the federal government. They are always, always making changes, and we meet every 2 years. So I sense from this bill that we're trying to catch up from something that happened after last legislative session closed, or your comments in your written material said as much. And then we're trying to hedge against something that they might do between now and the next legislative session. Would that be a good way to describe it?
Chairman Senator Walker, that's absolutely correct. We're doing the best we can to bring ourselves into compliance and leave enough flexibility that we can plan for what we hear is coming in the future from the federal government.
But, again, it always troubles me that I think the stopgap here is to allow the department to draft rules. Right?
Chairman, that is part of the stopgap. The other part in the bill is that it would be clear that our partners in TANF and Medicaid would still be entitled to information, and we would continue to exchange information
right.
with them.
Right. But I always have a concern with broad rulemaking authority being granted to agencies without some clear statutory directive. I just don't like that kind of stuff, because then you end up fighting the agency because they think they have broader power that would, you know, we make the mistake of drafting legislation that's somewhat vague, and then from there it gets even more out of control. So, all right. Do we have anything in the bill that directs what the rules are supposed to be?
Chairman, I was just checking on that language. On page 2 of the A. N. Gross bill, line 20 is the language where we tried to limit it and make it clear, but I don't know if we were successful in your eyes. The Department of Human Services shall adopt rules consistent with federal regulations governing confidentiality of child support program information. So what we're attempting to say is that our rules would simply reflect what they ultimately issue in regulations, but that do not currently exist.
Okay. All right. See, I'm almost getting to the point that I think that the legislature should actually approve agency rules each legislative session.
Chairman, I believe that topic has come up several times, yes.
And actually focus more of our time trying to actually govern the implementation of existing law as opposed to spending a lot of time trying to make new law.
Mm-hmm.
Because there are plenty of laws on the books, but sometimes we spend, you know, we get in this modality where we're running in place.
Mr. Kennedy, you don't think we need all these laws?
I'm convinced we don't. But we're moving them anyway because that's the modality we have. But yeah, it's what we do. I just think that the legislature ought to focus more on administrative rules and how agencies function and whether they're actually carrying out the legislative mandates. Kind of the check and balance on the executive branch of government, which is, I think, in theory what we're supposed to be doing. Anyway, we're going to hold on to this fine piece of legislation. and I want to think about the rule stuff. You'll give me the letter from the feds telling us we're going to do this, or we're going to suffer a huge penalty. I always like it when the feds step in and help us. Amazing. Well, they do. They send just enough to frustrate the daylights out of it.
Did you get some from Congressman Walden yesterday?
All right. Well, there's a check in the mail, I understand.
I heard that from attorneys before.
Yeah. 2111, is that the next least most complex?
That would be where we're at, Terminus, yes.
2111. Close the public hearing on 2113 and go to 2111. Ronell, star witness.
Again, for the record, Ronell Schenkel, Department of Justice. 2111 has two provisions or two primary focus areas in it. And the first one is another bring us into technical federal compliance, and the second is a customer service piece. I'll begin by mentioning that we worked on the topic of this particular bill pre-session with the Judicial Department, the State Bar Family Law Section, Oregon Youth Authority, Legal Aid Services of Oregon, the Employment Hearings Panel, and Oregon Men's Association. We worked specifically on some amendments on the House chamber with Judicial Department and Russ Lipetsky, who is a private sector attorney who does family law work. The two pieces of this bill, the first one, which is a federal compliance issue for us, has to do with modifications and the effective date of those modifications. Currently, our statute says that modifications can be effective once you get to that final order back to the date of the motion or the petition. A close technical reading of the federal regulation tells us that, in fact, we can only make modifications effective back to the date of service on the non-requesting party. And, in fact, if you think that logic through, that would make sense from a customer service perspective. Either mom or dad can request the modification. The person requesting it obviously knows that the legal action has begun. The other party does not know until they are served. So it makes sense that you would not go back further than the date that they first got notice of that modification. So that's the first proposal of a law amendment in this bill. The second piece is a customer service piece. And it has to do with credit against child support arrears. And there is a judicial remedy available that is not available in the administrative arena. And it has to do with a credit against arrears for the time that the children are in the physical custody of the obligor with the consent of the obligee. In other words, they have their parenting plan, and they do another special little weekend, week, something occurs where they do a temporary exchange. They both agree to it. It's not a change to the actual custody order, and they do not take care of satisfying the child support for that particular time period and then later come and say we need credit. In the judicial arena, they can get that right now. That's where the program would need to send them, is to court. We would like the ability to do that in the administrative arena. It's a fairly clear fact pattern. Everybody agrees it occurred, and we just need to credit that record. The amendment that was offered in the House actually came from Russ Lipetsky, and it takes that piece one step further and also says if we find that there has been an actual modification to the custody order, and yet that order doesn't say anything about adjusting the arrears, that we can then look at that order and make the necessary adjustment. The program agrees that's a very confusing issue for families. They often think if their custody order changes that that automatically took care of their child support as well. And so it would allow us a forum to look at that issue. Those are the two primary points in this bill.
All right, committee, any questions? All right. We've been stunned into complete silence.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Ringo.
I just want to focus on one thing, just to make sure I heard. To the extent that there is an arrearage, would this bill allow for more flexibility in modifying the ongoing support obligation?
Chairman and Senator Ringo, it doesn't specifically address the modification, so I think the answer to your question would be no. It's really addressing the scenario where the parties probably should have filed a satisfaction of a month or whatever the time period was that they exchanged the child and didn't do so. They aren't seeking a modification because it wasn't a permanent change, if I understood you correctly.
Right. Okay. But it would take into account, say, that month where the child was under different circumstances.
Chairman and Senator Ringo, that's what we're attempting to do, yes.
Okay.
And it might be done in conjunction with the modification request, absolutely.
I see. Thank you.
All right.
Any other questions? All right. I guess I can't bore the committee too much longer. Their threshold.
Like going to the dentist.
It is. Work session 2111.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Burdick.
I move House Bill 2111, A and Gross, to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Burdick moves House Bill 2111 to the floor of the Senate with due pass recommendation. Unamended. Discussion. Any objections to the motion? There's no objection to the motion.
I'll move this puppy.
Was any on? Motion passes. Senator Ringo.
Sure. What's this bill about now?
Yes, I will carry it.
Okay. There we go. Now, that gets us to the...
The complicated one.
More complicated. 2095. Public hearing, Ronell. By the way, thank you for putting together the packets of information. I think it's very helpful.
For the record, Ron L. Schenkel, Department of Justice. We're happy to give you all the information that we can. Maybe I should begin. I've already forewarned you this is the most complicated one. It is actually a new federal mandate for the child support program, and in fact, you'll notice we have an emergency clause on this bill that we actually need to have this in place by October to be in compliance with the federal regulation or perhaps suffer that penalty that I expressed in an earlier hearing. But maybe I should begin by saying we did a lot of work in the House chamber, and literally on the record and on camera, you can find Nancy Miller and Ron L. Schenkel holding hands and skipping up to the table to say that we had worked out all of the issues between the courts and the attorneys, the Judicial Department and the Department of Justice, and the amendments all are reflected in this bill. Having said that, we did a lot of work pre-session and with partners in the first chamber, and this bill basically changes. It repeals ORS 25255, which is the existing statute about health insurance and child support orders, and replaces it with a whole lot of new information based on the federal regulation. This has some parts that are not significantly different, and it has other changes that are a very good thing. You'll notice in the written testimony that I handed out that it actually walks you through each of the sections and points out to you any amendments we made on the House side to either improve the law or make it more clear. I'm guessing, Chairman, you do not want me to walk you through all of the sections, but instead just highlight some of the best points.
Yeah, why don't you give us a thumbnail sketch, and then we'll let it kind of spiral out of control after that.
A thumbnail sketch would be this. The important piece that was really worked on the amendments is the upfront piece of health insurance. What do you do when you're entering the order? More importantly, what do the judges, the hearings officers, do? What you will find in the Angros version of this bill is that we will, in all of the statutes where you might be entering a child support order, establishing an order, we will ask the trier, whoever that might be, to consider the issue of health insurance, consider whether or not mom or dad have that available. And we allow the flexibility for them then to order insurance, be carried by one of the parties, or in fact to order no insurance unless and until it becomes available in the future. So we worked to make sure that we have as much flexibility as possible for the individual case scenarios while staying in compliance with what the federal regulation says. Another important point we feel is...
Senator Walker.
Thank you. Wait a minute. Before you go on, am I to understand that if the obligor does not have health insurance through their employment, they do not have to provide it to the children?
Chairman and Senator Walker, basically what the statute will say is they must have health insurance available through an employer or union, and it needs to be two things, at a reasonable cost and accessible to the child.
So, again, my question is, if they don't have health insurance at their job, then they don't have to provide it to their children?
Chairman and Senator Walker, that is correct. If they do not have it available under those conditions at their job at the time we're establishing the order, what they will end up with in their order is language that says should it become available in the future, we will enforce it. But at that time, we will not order insurance because it will not be available to do so and to factor into the calculation.
I see. Okay.
Chairman and Senator Walker, that is actually not a change to current law. The next step that goes along with it that it is a change is the piece about accessible to the child. Currently, when we look at child support establishment, we do look at and factor into the calculation along with the cash, the cost of the insurance premiums. the new piece that the federal government has allowed us to add is that insurance even accessible to the child? And that is an important piece when you have the obligor and obligee in completely different parts of the state ordering insurance, causing an obligor to pay for it when we know the obligee and the child will never be able to access it because of locale. So it has added that additional piece of information to the scenario. We still have the tie also to the child support guidelines so that we will factor in the cost of premiums and be considering that together with the cost of the monetary obligation. So that's the upfront part of the process. The next step is the enforcement piece, and that's really the emphasis of the federal regulation. And the federal government, you're really going to love this, has mandated the National Medical Support Notice, a, I believe, 10-page form that all state child support programs must use. That National Medical Support Notice will replace the existing child support health insurance orders in Oregon. The good news for employers is it will look the same and come in the same no matter where it comes from. We have worked with Associated Oregon Industries, Bureau of Labor and Industries, and tried to do everything we can in Oregon to lessen the impact on the employers. What it, in fact, mandates for the child support program to do and some time frames for employers and health plan administrators is this. The program, upon learning of a new employment, place of employment, must within 2 days issue that National Medical Support Notice. So if we have an order that requires an obligor to carry health insurance, we have 2 days to get this notice out. Once the notice is served on the employer, they have 20 days to respond and let us know, in fact, whether or not it is available, what the costs are, and that type of information. If it is available, they forward on that same set of documents to the health plan administrator for that place of employment, and they have a total of 40 days to get the information about actually enrolling the dependents into the plan. The next step then, once we have the information that there is insurance, it is accessible, affordable, and in fact the dependents will be enrolled, is that an order to withhold for the premiums is served on the employer. And rather than an obligor making payments or volunteering to make payments through his payroll, the employer will simply withhold the premium, the payments, to ensure that the dependents are enrolled. Another key point of enforcement here that has been an issue in Oregon is current law says that we can order insurance for the dependents. We send the information to the company, but if the obligor is not enrolled, we can't ever get the dependents on the plan. National Medical Support says if the obligor is not enrolled, the employer must enroll them if that is a condition of getting the dependents on the plan as well.
That's a condition of what?
Of getting the dependents on the plan as well. So no longer will obligors be able to block our action by choosing not to sign themselves up for the health insurance coverage. So that's another key factor in the enforcement.
All right. Now, a question kind of following on Senator Walker's concern. If you had a series of health plans available to you, Kaiser or Regents or whatever, could the obligor pick the one that's not accessible to the child, or would they be required to pick the one that is accessible to the child?
Chairman, that is a very good question and is, in fact, addressed in the bill. And we would want to look at just the plans where they're affordable and accessible. But presuming that some obligors will have multiple choices, for example, state employees, where that may be true, there is language, and let me look quickly to find that for you, about the process that we will use. I can tell you that basically if the obligor is ordered to provide it, that health plan administrator is going to send information back to the enforcing agency to say, these are the plans available, which one do we enroll in? We are going to then, the enforcing agency is going to send that information, or at least a summary of that information, out to the obligee, and the obligee, together with the child support program, will determine which plan is most affordable, most accessible, and that the children shall be enrolled in. So it will actually be an obligee option rather than an obligor if more than one plan qualifies.
Okay. Makes sense.
Would you like me to find the section?
Yeah, this whole thing is really confusing because I didn't understand the last answer to the question. Well, I want to go back. First of all, I wrote down that the obligor is forced to get insurance from the employer if the child can be eligible. Is that what you said?
Chairman, Senator Walker, if there is insurance health insurance ordered in the child support order. And we send the national medical support notice to the employer, and they say, yes, in fact, it is available. And they begin processing the paperwork to the health plan administrator. If, when the health plan administrator attempts to sign up the dependents, they find out that the obligor isn't signed up and that's one of the conditions, then yes, they will sign up that obligor as well as the dependents.
Okay, and then the second question that the chair just asked you was, relating back to my concern earlier, if you can choose health insurance deliberately that sort of excludes, like in Eugene, I could buy health insurance that just is specific to physicians in Eugene. Let's say I had a child that lived in Portland. Can you choose to do that? And I didn't understand your answer.
Chairman Senator Walker, under the new provisions, you will not, because if there's another plan that is accessible to the child, then you will need to choose the accessible.
So who makes that decision, though? Is it the Child Support Division that makes this decision here?
If there are multiple plans available to that obligor, that information will be sent to the Child Support Program. It is likely that we would do an initial screening for that type of information,
okay,
but we will forward it on to the obligee to say, these are the options, or this is what we found, and get that obligee input.
That's a lot of micromanaging by your agency, isn't it?
To some degree, that is true.
Yeah. Okay. Now I've got it clear in my head. Thank you.
Chair Minister, the language about that obligee election is actually in Section 6, and I speak to it on page 3 and 4 in the testimony.
And that was an amendment according to your document that the House put in? Is that right?
The amendment... We had language in there, but it wasn't clear that we would be doing so in consultation with the obligee, so they added clarifying language, yes.
Clarifying, okay. How does this function with people who are, their incomes are borderline? How does it interplay with the Oregon Health Plan, for instance? Or?
Chairman, it's two different questions perhaps there. As you go further in the testimony in the bill, you will find that the way we are laying this out, the proposal in the statute, is that cash income withholding, it's likely an obligor is going to have a monetary obligation and then health insurance. Most of them do. So the cash withholding will have priority first. The employer will withhold what they owe for the monthly child support. Health insurance premiums will be second. You'll notice that we have drafted into the law, and again in the House, there was some clarifying language in this area. But in Section 7, it talks about the total of the withholding for those two types of child support cannot exceed 50% of the obligor's net disposable income, unless there's an exception found by the court why they should do so. And ultimately, the Consumer Credit Protection Act cap plays in for some of our obligors. So that's sort of the straight monetary calculation piece and the protection, so to speak, that we built in. With regard to the Oregon Health Plan, that is not today and is not anticipated to be considered viable coverage for the dependents if there are other health plans available that the parent can, that are reasonable in cost and accessible to the child,
right,
and the parent can provide.
Right.
Those cases, in fact, are referred. Oregon Health Plan, if that's the only thing a child is receiving, are referred to the Child Support Program and are worked by district attorneys as well as the Division of Child Support to see if we can find health insurance through one of the parents, through the other parent.
All right. Council.
Chair, members of the committee, Ms. Shekel, you also have an A3 amendment you're proposing, are you not?
That is correct. Chairman, as Council Taylor, we did work with Bureau of Labor and Industries, and the area that we specifically focused on with them is liability. The A3 amendments you have before you are additional and final technical amendments to that portion of the statute. Briefly, there is a shift, as you may imagine, based on what I've described to you, where today it's up to the obligor to pay their premiums and cause that health insurance to be paid. In the future, that will be shifted to the employer to make it happen. So the liability shifts from the obligor to the employer. If the employer fails to withhold the premiums, fails to comply with this order, there is some liability. So we worked with Bureau of Labor and Industry because they have the expertise on what that language should look like. It mirrors, with some amendments in our housekeeping bill, the language in income withholding. And there's a representative here from Bureau of Labor if anybody has any questions, but these are additional technical amendments to the language already in the bill.
Has AOI or NFIB or employer groups seen the amendment?
Bureau of Labor and Industries has seen it. I do not believe, Chair Minnis, that Associated Oregon Industries necessarily has reviewed this final one, but they saw the earlier drafts of the bill that has the substantive language, and these are technical adjustments.
Right. So what else do you want to tell us?
I also need to tell you, in addition to the amendments, that we are seeking a referral to Ways and Means on this bill. It is a new federal mandate. It is obviously, as Senator Walker has pointed out, new work for the child support program. And given the resources that we have, we are seeking some additional assistance with that. In working on this bill in the House chamber and in speaking with Legislative Fiscal, they asked that we work through both chambers because there was so much technical amendment talk going on that could impact the fiscal, and wait and have the referral come from second chamber rather than first. I believe with the A3 amendments we will have a clean bill ready to go down to Ways and Means if you so choose to move it.
All righty. I'm not going to move the bill today. I want to have an FIB and AOI take a look at the A3 amendments.
Okay.
Make sure that they're comfortable with it.
Chairman, would you like me to do that with AOI?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay.
So the employer groups at least have an opportunity to feel comfortable with that. Bill, anything else we need to know?
Chairman of the committee, I think that's it.
All right. Anyone else wishing to testify on this fine piece of legislation? There's no one else willing to step forward. Ronell, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And we are adjourned.
That's a lot of interest.